Carlisle Holte, and this is this evening's installment in the series on God and Faith in Autobiography. And this evening, with a trailer from last evening's overlong lecture on Lewis's experience of joy, I want to get on to the announced theme for this evening, which will probably trail over into tomorrow evening, on the baptism of the imagination. You perhaps heard the announcement at table that there will be a meeting of volunteers going on in the adjacent room. And Elmer Witt was kind enough to say they would be there, and apparently they have more fun than we do and laugh louder and like it. So he wanted to warn me not to be distracted. I said I had warmed up last evening talking loud, and perhaps they would come in and complain about my noise level. He said not to worry. At any rate, let me pick up toward the end of last evening's material on joy and read again. This is a paragraph that you tend to read again and again and again and find sometimes new puzzlers and sometimes some fresh insights. And this is what Lewis says in one of the longer statements about this joy. With that plunge back into my own past, there arose at once, almost like heartbreak, the memory of joy itself, the knowledge that I had once had what I had now lacked for years, that I was returning at last from exile in distant lands to my own country, and the distance of the twilight of the gods and the distance of my own past joy, both unattainable, flowed together into a single, unendurable sense of desire and loss, which suddenly became one with the loss of the whole experience, which, as I now stared round that dusty schoolroom like a man recovering from unconsciousness, had already vanished, had eluded me at the very moment when I could first say, "It is." And at once I knew, with fatal knowledge, that to have it again was a supreme and only important object of desire. Elsewhere, carrying on in that note of almost being violated by something taking over one's consciousness and one's emotions, Lewis talks about a stab of pain that he calls joy. Well, it's pain and a good feeling. So it's something very peculiar that needs further definition. As I said last evening, it is not to be confused with happiness. And that's something of our problem. We might not all know the song, "I want to be happy, and I want to make you happy too." We are obsessed, as was mentioned in an earlier context today, with pleasure, with recreation that makes us feel good. We have a generation which is going on trips, not bus and boat trips to Holden, but some other kind of supreme experience. We have those who want to achieve a high, whether by some fantastic, frantic exercise or by use of some artificial means such as dope-induced highs. Now, that would be completely out of the realm of Lewis's sense here. You remember again that bit of poetry from Wordsworth. This is something that comes unexpectedly, unannounced. It is very brief. But as you had in the last lines of the citation I just read, Lewis said, "I knew I wanted to have this experience again." But he goes on to point out that he cannot artificially stimulate this. He can help it, and sometimes it comes, but there is no step-by-step progression to the point that, there it is again. Now, some of the things that followed from his northernness experience were an affection for and an openness to the music of Richard Wagner. That's rather an unusual thing. It is tied in, of course, with the old stories of the German and Scandinavian god complex, the twilight of the gods, the Nibelungen, and all those other titles in Wagner. And there is a richness here in the music, and something compelling, it is strong. There's something of profound mystery in it. The interesting thing with Lewis is that he was not particularly fond of most music. But he had this early experience with northernness and this discovery of Wagner. And the schoolboy, with a few shillings in his pocket, his allowance, instead of going like most of the boys did to the sweet shop, you see, I don't want to knock our diet here, but I assume that we are sort of supplementing. Otherwise, we wouldn't have that lineup at the snack shop. And where's that bag of popcorn that came in here? Thank you. That will tell those people in the next room we're having fun. But these schoolboys would go down to the sweet shop and they'd buy some of the sickliest, sweetest candies that the English schoolboy likes. They were made available, you know, for a half a penny or a penny, something there to sort of fix up your stomach. Or a sweet roll, a bun, or something like that. And Lewis is taking that precious money, and his stomach probably grumbled like the others, and saving it up to buy records of Wagner. And then he found some pictures that not too great illustrator had done of some of those scenes. And here, too, he found something of mystery, something that struck a little bit of that pang. Now, as I say, there was just no artificial way. There was no sort of religious experience that he could go through. In fact, he found those to be rather dull, the daily routine of a scripture that was read very often very badly and hymns that no one knew or sang very well. I don't want to inject this too harshly, but in later life, when he wanted to go to church because he felt that his commitment to the Lord also involved this, and he wasn't keen on it. Remember I said he was a good man, but he had a hard time. One thing that sort of kept him away from church was that he simply could not stand organ music. That did exactly the wrong thing for him. But when he talks later on about northernness and analyzes it, in the way I said these people are doing, they have this experience, they reflect on it, and they find some meaning. What was the meaning of northernness? What did he discover there, other than a body of music? Theologically, it's a very important thing and a very rich insight. He said in northernness, he found holiness. Now, this doesn't mean that he wanted to change his nationality and become a Scandinavian. It doesn't mean that he glorified those old myths of Thor and Freya and the rest. But there was a sense of the holy. And this is, I think, an element that we have, in a sense, to restore always. But our age particularly needs this. I suppose if we have heard about this sort of thing, we've been warned off because this is something mystical. We cannot really describe it, but it is there. Tom Christensen is talking about some of these things that African natives experience. Not in this precise way, but we're also familiar here. I was looking at the magazine Pacific Northwest after my evening meal, and there are pictures there of some of the Native Americans from this area. They had certain holy places. I've worked on one for 30 years. We talk about Manitou Heights. There were Native Americans in that area also. I don't know what it was. I haven't really read much about it. But God, Manitou, was somehow closer there. In part, it was higher up, and I know that too, because that's even, well, no, not quite as far up as Chalet number 9, but I have walked steps up and figured out when I was not too happy about it that before I sit down in my office chair, I have climbed up the equivalent of a 10-story building. And then I go down two long flights to check my office mailbox to see if there's anything there, and I go up and down all day long. It does help my appetite. But Manitou Heights has something of an age-old holiness. I'm not sure that the Norwegians who founded St. Olaf knew about that, or they might have built some other place than a nice flat Norwegian type of place. A sense of holiness. There are books that talk about this in a formal way. There's a classic by Rudolf Otto called The Idea of the Holy. I don't think he uses the phrase, but elsewhere this phrase is used, that there is something eerie about it. There is a spookiness. And here too, of course, we say holy, spooky. What are we here, you know? Is this supposed to be some kind of a scout organization where soon we will turn out the lights and start telling ghost stories? And then we go out and it's rather dark out there and we say, maybe there are ghosts around here. To say spooky, eerie, holy, is rather foreign to us. But we don't have to depend on these external things, because in places like the Psalms, and in places like Isaiah, in places like the Book of Revelation, we have this constant implementation of the idea. When Isaiah heard his call, it was in a vast chamber where God was exalted, and the angels were flying about, and their song was holy, holy, holy. And he's overwhelmed by it, to the extent that he says, woe is me, I'm undone. Here I am in the presence of holiness, and I can't stand this. When Moses was called, he saw this bush that burned and wasn't consumed. That's peculiar, that's eerie, that's spooky. Lightning can start fires in bushes and trees, but then it burns itself out. And then he is told, take off your shoes, this is a holy place. And that recognition that this was a special place for meeting God dictated to him his act and his receptivity. God is there. The Book of Revelation has that same temper. It is not trying to portray a heaven that is comfortable to us. Some years ago, there was, I think it was sort of an early musical or something, the black man's idea of heaven. There were fish fries there, and the men smoked cigars, and they put, according to this, they put firmament into some kind of a stew that they were making. Then when the Lord came around and tasted it and said, needs a little more firmament. And we sometimes create a heaven like that. I said earlier, one of the weird things I sometimes think about and write down, then I say, some of the far-out things. But for some of us who read, and I'm one of them, and are addicted to it, and you bought a book, I resisted the temptation. I go through bookstores singing, "Yield not to temptation." But I can picture myself coming to heaven and saying, "Thank you, Lord. Where's the library?" But that doesn't become the picture of that. And it's not a matter of saying, well, we're going to be uncomfortable here all the time, as we used to be when we were forced to wear Sunday clothes and everything was tight and it was too hot in the summer and everything was uncomfortable and heaven was going to be anything like this. Let's pass it on to the heathen. We didn't want it. Now, this idea of holiness is important, not just as something strange, individualistic in Lewis's life, but as he progresses in his movement toward God. He's feeling sort of haunted. You've picked up the book, you might have read the titles. He talks about a sort of a chess game. He's playing chess with God, and he's not doing very well. There's one chapter that's titled Mate. It's a long time since I've played much chess at all, but that says, watch it. You're getting close to being clobbered. And then another one, checkmate. And that's where, well, you might have two or three moves left, but whatever you do, the game is lost. And Lewis portrays God as pursuing him. Another image that's very applicable here, though it isn't precisely stated, is one that Francis Thompson has done beautifully in a poem, The Hound of Heaven. We mustn't think that either Francis Thompson, who was pretty much of a wastrel but sort of came through in faith, was running out looking for God. Nor was Lewis. Lewis was backing up as fast as he could. As Thompson said, I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the labyrinth and ways and under hidden laughter. But God, like the hound of heaven, just is never outdistanced. And he's there. You probably hear his footfall. You can hear his breath. We talk about this sometimes. I feel a hot breath on my neck. That's Lewis's kind of language. Instead of saying that he was seeking God in all of this, he had this Augustinian sense that there was something missing. That was the joy. It was never fulfilled. It was always teasing him. But he said, going after God, looking for him, that's about like the mouse looking for the cat. And so when he comes to talk about his conversion, it's in rather strange language. And it certainly does not sort of glorify him. This is on page 228. I hear the books have sold out, so some of you at least might want to make a page notation. If there's a copy of this on reserve, I don't know, but here we go. You must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen, night after night, feeling, whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1921, I gave in and admitted that God was God, and knelt and prayed. Isn't that wonderful? He has been caught. And this is, of course, sort of a shocker. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. Strange, isn't it? Some years ago, I heard about a man that I had known at a distance from college days, superb athlete, who enjoyed the athlete's prerogatives of obeying whatever rules he felt like and disobeying the rest and challenging the dean to throw him out. And that went on as long as he was a student. This was the story I heard after a good many years when he'd carried out a professional career and a coaching career. He came back to the college area, set himself up in business, and he sought out a pastor that he had heard, I think primarily on occasional Saturday or daily chapels. I don't know how he even got there with his general attitude. But he sought this man out, and this was his brief spiritual autobiography. I knew all the time that I was here that God was after me, but I wasn't having any of it. Now, would you instruct me? I want to join the church. Now, it's an interesting sidelight to this. I've mentioned very much in passing Lewis's older brother, Warren, who had also drifted away. We don't have so much of a spiritual autobiography. We have his diary, and in that he very carefully states that though in his role in the military, he had to report for church drill, and there was no skipping it and saying, well, I don't believe that. He was a member of, at that time, His Majesty's forces, and he'd better be there or lose his commission. But just about this same time, you find mentioned in Warren's diaries that something is going on in him too. And without the kind of intriguing language we just heard in C.S. Lewis's record, it says, I began to pray again. And he went to church with the intention of getting something out of it, not just conforming. And he returned to the Eucharist. And he too had a struggle. It was not only a struggle of faith, but along the way he had developed a drinking problem. And so later on he could look back and say, I have had a good Lent. I haven't touched a drop of liquor. I've had tea for breakfast. And he goes on in that same kind of victorious struggle for the faith for the rest of his life. Incidentally, he also makes, in this case, a specific reference to Francis Thompson's The Hound of Heaven. He'd heard those footsteps behind him also. And he had, as his younger brother had done, given up. Now, there's one thing here to notice. Let God be God. We get into theological language. We say he is now not an atheist any longer, but C.S. Lewis is a theist. He believes that there is not only a God with a lowercase g, but capital G. As I say, one reason that I think we need to work on this is that the idea of God has been democratized in so many hearts. I won't say that the use now in the Lord's Prayer as we have it is a supreme example of that. I don't know what trouble we had exactly with addressing God as the thou, learning a little bit different language. The you seems almost too palsy-walsy. Some of you may have read some years ago, when it was popular, a play, The Man Who Came to Dinner. Remember that this big-name dramatic person came out to the small town where they have a theatrical group going, and he falls and breaks a leg, and he is condemned to stay there. He hates it, but of course his hostess eats it up. She has this big guy here. And he's there over Thanksgiving, and he is eating Thanksgiving dinner with the family. And of course, He's the most important person and the most literary, so he is asked to say the prayer before they eat. And I cannot forget that palsy way in which he conforms to that request. "Well, sir, where is the holy God? Where is the God of the angelic trumpets? Where is the God whose presence intimidates us and says, we are God's creatures?" Now, that doesn't mean that we are made ashes. As the 8th Psalm says, "Thou hast made us a little lower than the angels," and it's that little lower that we should remember, and that the Word brings home to us. I don't think you find it in Paul that he is so palsy with God either. Well, there are some, and I think they can even take the majesty of nature and abuse it to the minimizing of God, and there are others who see close-up in nature a reminder. When I finished college back quite a few years ago, I went up to northern Minnesota to teach Vacation Bible School. I was passed around pretty quickly because no one could really afford to feed an extra month for very long. I think I had about 8 different locations for Vacation Bible School. Lovely area. I looked out our school window one day and saw a deer there too, just like Holden. And I stayed with the Greens for some time. They had a little acreage. He had fled Minneapolis, where he'd worked on the streetcar, I remember, because of his recurrent asthma, and gone up to the woods, where he felt a good deal better. When I came there, he said, "I've got to take you to the pines someday." And that was all capitalized. So a Saturday came, and I think that was the day I had a little personal confrontation with the use of an old-fashioned scythe, because we were cutting hay in an area that you couldn't bring in even a horse-drawn mower. And we went over in the pines, and here was a virgin stand of timber. Some of you have seen it. It got left behind because the timber companies couldn't get access to it. They wanted it. It was beautiful, powerful, strong stuff. And you know how that grows. All the lower branches had dropped off, and there was just that little bit of the top, and you stood there. And Green said, "I come here every so often because I realize here how great God is and how small I am." I think that's something of what is being renewed in us. We don't get it in Lady of the Lake 2. We don't get it by just standing around here, but we get it by as close contact as we can with the majesty of this. This whole majestic eruption of power. Some of you know from even closer experience than we, who just got samples of Mount St. Helens ash, the tremendous power when that long dead volcano sneezed. And there was the moving of so much rock and such a concussion. You couldn't be around without realizing that, sure, we've got atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs, but the power of these natural forces is much, much greater than that. That's God at work. Even the grinding out of that fantastically deep Lake Chelan, you wouldn't find a contractor in the world that would have the stupidity to take a contract to do that. God did it. When you meet him, like C.S. Lewis, proper attitude is to recognize him, to bow before him. See what I play again here. Now, probably stop for a few minutes here, as I keep at least some of my promise from last time and for this time. Comment on this matter of joy, your puzzlement, probably, or probably your own experience of something like this that's been meaningful.
You would go along with starting his service by saying the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth be silent before him.
That doesn't stand in the LBW, I guess, but I don't know what's wrong with it at all. And it doesn't have to be those precise words. And I don't object to having little children who can't quite appreciate that they're here. But I do object to the idea of people sort of sauntering in and never finding a holy place where they meet God. How we do this, it's not a matter of architecture, it's a matter of a temper, of a mood. It doesn't mean that we don't dare to move, but somehow, it seems to me, in the God with whom we relate, belongs according to our biblical background. God is a great God. Probably this one reason that we sing with right zest, How Great Thou Art. Of course, we sang Holy, Holy, Holy to death. But that and music, I can't even make this ring with the jingle-jangle dullness of a great deal of contemporary religious music. To say that we should be hearing Gretschanenoff or Christensen for that matter seems to be just picking favorites and putting this music up above the standard of the ordinary people. Some of those great Russian composers had a sense of the awesomeness of God. And they weren't content to let a little jingling, jangling noise come out, because this God rolled thunderclaps and sent down lightnings and brooded over the entire world. Should I be nasty and say not just over Nashville? Now, it's awfully biased. Maybe Nashville can give us a sense of God's greatness. But if it, or LBW, or any of the church publishing houses, or anything you'd name, any traveling church choir or college choir, can't deepen our sense and give us some thrills up and down our backbone once in a while, a little bit of almost an electrifying of what hair we've got left, we're the poorer. God isn't trying to make us miserable. But again, here, to follow along what I said last evening at such great length, some of the other stuff is nonsense over against God. Well, sir, it's nonsense. O Lord, our God, how majestic are all thy works. That's the truth. And Lewis knows it. He comes later on to what we and he knew was the fullness of this. And that is an explicit recognition of the divinity of Jesus Christ. And here in the next to the last page of Surprised by Joy is his statement about that. I know very well when, but hardly how, the final step was taken. I was driven to Whipsnade one sunny morning. This is really a very strange holy place. You're supposed to know it. Whipsnade was a zoo. And he was going to watch the animals at the zoo. Hardly a holy experience. Oh, by the way, also,
he was riding in a sidecar with Warren driving the motorcycle. When we set out, I did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And when we reached the zoo, I did. Not in great emotion. Emotional is perhaps the last word we can apply to some of the most important events. It was more like when a man, after long sleep, still lying motionless in bed, becomes aware that he is now awake. And it was like that moment on top of the bus, ambiguous. Freedom or necessity? Or do they differ at their maximum? At that maximum, a man is what he does. There is nothing of him left over or outside the act. Well, I said earlier, at the very outset, that we find varying descriptions of conversions, religious experiences, and this is about as varied as you can find. But it emerges after almost a trial and error sequence with this conviction. And the follow-through is, and even before this particular moment, he said, Jesus Christ is the Son of God, going back to church, tolerating the organ music, tolerating a lot of people who are just on church parade, room means nothing, because that's part of what it means to commit yourself to the God who is God. And now to complete... Not all we're going to say about Lewis, but most of what we're going to say about this matter of joy, he has another strange paragraph about this. After all, there's the title, and throughout here, much more than I've indicated, there's a reference to joy. And you say, all right, now, how does this work? We've been without power off and on today. Well, what happened up there, and they were without lights next door by the time we started, where did they find the light switch? They said there's no light downstairs. We've got it here. And we're wondering, I suppose, when we get back, whether there'll be lights in our rooms. We'd like to trace it all out. And joy should be the connection. It's all pretty loose, so we think, okay, last page, here's a master writer, and what will he say about it? But what in conclusion of joy? For that, after all, is what the story has mainly been about. To tell you the truth, the subject has lost nearly all interest for me since I became a Christian. I cannot, indeed, complain, like Wordsworth, that the visionary gleam has passed away. I believe if the thing were at all worth recording, that the old stab, the old bittersweet, has come to me as often and as sharply since my conversion as at any time of my life whatever. No complaints, still happening. But still, it isn't as important. But I now know that the experience, considered as a state of my own mind, had never had the kind of importance I once gave it. And here's a sentence I have highlighted. That means I've had a pen that marks without blotting out, it was valuable only as a pointer to something other and outer. What that other was, in doubt, the pointer naturally, or while that other was in doubt, the pointer naturally loomed large in my thoughts. When we are lost in the woods, the sight of a signpost is a great matter. He who first sees it cries, "Look!" The whole party gathers around and stares. I hope that isn't happening to any of you going up toward the lakes. But when we have found the road and are passing signposts every few miles, we shall not stop and stare. They will encourage us, and we shall be grateful to the authority that set them up. But we shall not stop and stare, or not much. Not on this road, though their pillars are of silver and their lettering of gold. We would be at Jerusalem. Lewis has pretty largely answered the story of how he moved from atheism to the Christian faith. But then I think he wants to say, all right, some of you asked for this. Now be content. Don't ask me for any more. The important thing now is I am on the way, and this familiar figure appears here. Whether we say we would see Jesus, we are on our way to Jerusalem. He is in the Christian life. And how he got here now has become less important. I suppose we've been challenged, most of us, by people who say, are you a Christian? You say, yes. Well, when did you become one? How? And you say, well, I was born in a good Christian home. I was baptized. I was sealed as a believer then. I had some meaningful confirmation instruction. I don't really feel that I have gone out like the prodigal and come back. But for some people, it isn't satisfactory to say that I am a Christian. You have to be able to detail. Again here, this is sort of a nastiness. But probably we owe it to people to say that while we are called to give an answer to those who ask us, we're not called to yield to their stereotypes. I cannot imagine, and in fact I know in some of his later writing, Lewis was quite intolerant of those who had sort of a prepackaged how to become a Christian structure, which they felt, you know, fit all sizes, sort of like the Tom McCann shoe store, where I can't buy my shoes, so I'm angry at them. I figured that if you wear a size 9, quadruple D, they can fit you. There's probably 16 models. And if you want a 12A, they say, go barefoot. So here is the end of it, and we have something more to say, and let's get on with that something more. Because we know that Lewis was the creative writer of so many things, it's a sort of a catchphrase, but I'd like to dwell on it as something more important in terms of the totality of the conversion. And the announced title was The Baptism of the Imagination. It's a phrase that Lewis himself uses. If I can get book and note together here, I can read a bit more, and this is not going to be very long. This, for you book people, is on page 181. But now I saw the bright shadow coming out of the book into the real world and resting there, transforming all common things and yet itself unchanged. Or more accurately, I saw the common things drawn into the bright shadow. Whence is this to me? In the depth of my disgraces, in the then invincible ignorance of my intellect, all this was given me without asking, even without consent. My imagination was, in a certain sense, baptized. The rest of me, not unnaturally, took longer. This is simply a matter of saying that the growth in grace has a beginning and a continuity, and some places takes a good deal of time. We have a little household game. My wife insists that I'm so patient. She usually tells this to some of the family. Her family don't know me too well yet. She says, oh, Carlisle, you're so patient, aren't you? And I say, yes, I am patient. But I remember a story also of an older man who had a little bit too much of temper. He was a Christian. And some young Christian said, well, I respect you for your Christian faith, but I do think you should learn to control your temper. It really makes me doubt the sincerity of your faith. And the older man, this is probably where I got the model, said, young man, I want you to understand that I control more bad temper in 1 hour than you do in a week. There are different problems, and some of us find it easy. Some of us, are naturally sort of quiet, and we can be contemplative, and we can sit in church. And of course, some of us have had children, and we were children who were built on springs. My youngest of my three grandchildren, little Christopher, is going to be something else. He is a chatterbox. He is constantly in movement. He got through his terrible twos into thrice more terrible threes, I think. What's going to happen to him? Well, we can't give him back. We're going to keep him. Because he's got something there which, when baptized and controlled and directed, is probably going to shame me all hollow, and he's got that kind of verve and direction. And this is really what I'm talking about in the baptism of the imagination, so far as Lewis is concerned. That's sort of a little model. His whole self, in his whole being, is involved in the conversion. He'd been this reader. He'd also been a storyteller from his childhood. Left to his own, and he and his older brother created little worlds of their own. And there are still, and you will find them in that book, isn't Images of C.S. Lewis, reproductions. He wrote these stories, and he illustrated them, and he watercolored them, and there are marvelous things here, castles and knights, and even had some original Muppets. They are humans. He puts them in various situations. He has a frog dressed up in a button down the front coat who is the prime minister of this country that he's created. So Narnia is just of a character, and he never felt that he had to abandon his imagination or suppress it. He's a born storyteller. That's just one facet of a remarkable person. And there's where some of our gift from Lewis comes. Here's a statement made by another storyteller with whom Lewis associated a good deal. He says that in the writings of Lewis, the supernatural is being taken seriously and is being brought disconcertingly close to our own experience. How? Well, a lot of it by stories. Marvelous stories. And I wanted to retell some of them. I wish I could do it pretty well. I got a little preface here I want to give too. I see it. I can pull the same game I pulled last night. If you really want to interrupt, by all means do. Some of you have read Elie Wiesel. Have you? No? Yeah. Marvelous storyteller. I heard him out in Philadelphia at a conference quite a few years ago. And he was introduced, and oh, here's this man who's written X number of books and lectured, and survivor of the Holocaust. Little insignificant looking man stands up there and says, "I am just a storyteller." And here he has professors of philosophy, educators working in literature and writing books, and he says, "I'm going to tell you some stories." And he captivates that sophisticated crowd, story after story, in this great Jewish tradition. And when he was through, we applauded and we gave him a really meaningful standing ovation, and wouldn't sit down until he came out. And that's the only time in my life I've ever heard a storyteller give an encore. But it was what we wanted. There are storytellers. Martin Luther was one. Some time ago, I wrote a short paper. I had done some special study of Luther's exposition of Genesis 22. When I figured that my students behind my back were saying I was asking them to write too many pages, that this was what I would fix them with, because I was having them do some expositions, I told them, Luther gave lectures on the 50 chapters of Genesis. It fills 8 good-sized volumes, running around 400 pages each. And I said, now you're supposed to take a little segment of a story and I want you to write 3 or 4 pages. Martin Luther wrote on Genesis 22 and he wrote about 80 or 90 pages. Now, come on, you know, 4 or 5 pages isn't too much. Well, Luther sort of ran off at the mouth sometimes. We know that. But I read a whole lot of other commentaries, good ones. And I found that this marvelous story of Abraham and Isaac, they could retell and comment on in a page or two. And Luther goes on and on. Why? Because he had the imagination to follow a story here. And Luther might not have been a modern person who is shedding his chauvinism. You might have felt that Katie belonged in the kitchen and in the hog house and the slaughterhouse, although she didn't sit there very easily. She came out and got into the dinner table conversation and criticized Martin himself. There's a marvelous story when Luther was brooding one day early in the morning. Nothing was right, and he was just in a very bad mood. Katie disappeared, and she came back again a little while, and she was all dressed in black in mourning. Luther said, what's going on? She said, well, the way you have been today, God must have died. So I'm in mourning for you. Well, let me get that business of chauvinism in there. Well, you know, Abraham followed the command of God and got things together and took Isaac and his servants and the donkey loaded with wood and took off and went off. And Luther says, because he gets into the story, how did Sarah feel about this? What was going on in her? Not that he'd said, well, I'm going off and kill Isaac. Something strange was going on here, and she wasn't made privy to it. And there are other elements like that. Some of them were worked on. People did ask, well, what did Isaac do? Did he try to run away? He was old enough. Was he just very acquiescent? I'm not so concerned about how Luther retold the story, but that he got at it. And why am I so high on stories, and why do I see so much potential in Lewis too? Because a story is not something simple and naive. There is a background that you have to assume. We open up a strange book, different culture, a whole lot of things that just glide over our heads because we don't appreciate this. Biblical stories are of that kind. And we don't get nuances. Here's another example, and I did ferret this out, and this goes back to another memorable time at our summer theological conference in St. Olaf some years ago. We had a very distinguished biblical scholar from Yale University. He has written a massive commentary on the book of Exodus. He's done a lot of research in history of interpretation. And like Elie Wiesel, back those earlier years, Brevard Childs told biblical stories and expanded on them. Now, you all know the story of Samson and Delilah and the pillars of the temple that he pulled down. And that list, it took him quite a while to recreate this because it was not embellishment, but it was opening up the story. And there are a whole lot of elements there. We see Samson not just as a rough and ready, hurly-burly type, but one who had a calling to be a judge of God. He was committed to a life of purity, and he was an impure guy, sought out a prostitute. He was supposed to eat only clean foods, according to Jewish law. Went along and he found some honey in a dead animal. He shouldn't have touched the animal even. He reached his hand in and took the honey and ate it. Very mixed up kid, you know, standing I don't know how tall. And there is one phrase that Brevard Childs imprinted on my mind because he looked at the story and said, here it is. There's more here than meets the eye. And this is the prayer that Samson prayed when the little boy had led him to the supporting pillars in the temple of the Philistines' God. Then Samson called to the Lord and said, O Lord God, remember, I pray thee, and strengthen me, I pray thee, only this once. And that had been sort of Samson's career, this one doesn't count. You know, this is an exception. God will have mercy. And even in the last here, when there's a nobility about him, he's still coming like somebody who has wasted his life. He said, just this one thing, Lord, that's all I ask. That's reasonable. It flips the story into a wholly new context. You've got to go back and read it all again. And that's the marvel of not only the imagination, but the imaginative entering in. And that leaves me, as I expected, with some of Lewis's stories, The Great Divorce for one, and some things from Perelandra, where he scores theological points like crazy through a story. Captivates. That's one of the happiest baptisms in the Western world, when his baptism was baptized and retained as part of the total gift of a very great Christian man. Thank you again.